Today is Monday, October 26, 2020. This is part 9, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Kurt Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Kurt. How are you today?
I'm good, Tom. You good. Are too.
Yeah, well, thank you. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yeah.
Thank you. Last time we were talking about your time in Olympic National Park, and I wonder if there were any other issues that you wanted to talk about. One thing I was thinking of was the changes in logging and the concept of, you know, we could just log our forests forever, and that was really changing. Did you see that in Olympic? Did you deal with that?
Well, not so much in Olympic National Park, but on the perimeter. You know, that particular time frame revolved around the spotted owls. At least that's what the logging community thought.
Okay.
What I didn't see when I was there, but I saw the historical photos of the old growth forests that were being logged. And the trees, of course, the logging trucks were not quite as large and powerful as they were when I was there. But, you know, one trunk, one cedar or one Douglas fir would fill up that trailer, that logging trailer.
Wow.
And, the train cars were smaller, but one tree trunk would fill up one car. And over time, the concept, I imagine, was this is all bountiful and we can never over-harvest. Well, in the 70s, they started to recognize, Forest Service started to recognize, and the environmental groups started to recognize that they were over-harvesting. And they got to a point where very little old growth outside of the national park still remained.
Wow.
And Forest Service had to change their harvesting tactics. Harvesting schedules, and you know, over time, the trucks rolling through Port Angeles would have 20 trees on their trailer because they had just cut all the old growth that was accessible, and then in addition to that, you had the spotted owl, which had been declared an endangered species, which meant the Forest Service had to readjust their plans, which directly impacted where and how often and how you could log. And instead of clear-cutting, they went to, I forget what they called it. It was basically clear-cutting, but you left five or six, quote, seed trees on the 180 acres that you just cleared.
So there'd be 180 acres of cleared hillside and five trees on it.
Yeah, it might have been 25 trees on 180 acres. It,
okay.
But, you know, in driving down the road, it's like, oh, there goes another clear cut. You fly over on a commercial flight, and you can just see the peninsula being denuded.
Wow.
But that's Forest Service. That's multiple use.
Right.
So the loggers were, again, having their economic feasibility impacted. And so they were angry about the spotted owl. They were angry at the Forest Service for implementing these new changes. At one point, you know, there it's might come as a surprise for me to say this, but they were an honorable bunch of men,
mm-hmm.
few women, They were angry, but they were not violent. I think I mentioned at the last interview that, well, maybe I didn't mention it. While I was East District Ranger, we got a call that there was a spotted owl nailed to the entrance sign of Olympic National Park going up to Hurricane Ridge. So I went up and retrieved this dead spotted owl. So I guess you could consider that violent. Somebody had killed a spotted owl, or somebody had picked up a roadkill of a spotted owl.
Right.
We didn't.
I
remember one demonstration out in Forks. Chris Fairbanks was the United States Forest Service law enforcement officer out in Forks. And she lived in the Forks community, and she knew the loggers. And through whatever means, whether they contacted her or she contacted them, instead of having a violent demonstration, they made arrangements to be arrested and made sure that all the news outlets were there, the newspapers and the radio stations, TV stations. And we sent a few rangers out to back her up, and the Forest Service sent a few other law enforcement officers from other areas. And so they had their demonstration and made their point and then refused to move. And Chris and her team moved in and, arrested 8 of them or something. And that was the agreement that they had made. And they got their point across, and Chris was able to do her job, and there wasn't a bunch of looting and vandalism as I sit here in current day America. So there were the peaceful protests, and there were some other incidents. I don't recall what they were, but you could consider them to be violent, I guess, but. It was basically just working out your frustration. And an interesting thing to me, Tom, is maybe folks that listen to this in the future won't realize just how drastically our country has harvested its forests. I read a book in, the 1990s, early 1990s. It's more of a like a magazine format. Can't remember the organization that put it out, but they did an analysis of how much virgin forest was left compared to when this country was founded, including the oaks and the walnuts and the pecans, and, all the species back east, not just the old growth out west. And in the 1990s, they estimated that 85% of the virgin forests had already been harvested.
Wow.
And you think about the changes that has created in the ecosystem and the animal life. It's pretty drastic.
Yeah,
so phenomenal. They were down to the last 15%, and much of it was in Olympic National Park and North Cascades National Park, Mount Rainier National Park. So the Park Service wasn't real popular with the locals who depended on the forest industry.
And the trouble, that's for sort of western hardwoods or western softwoods even. I'm not sure if I have the terms correct there, but I was thinking about the eastern forest, which didn't have, large parks, large swaths of federal land set aside to be unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. Again, going back to the Organic Act of the Park Service.
Right. Well, and they had the populations.
Right.
They had the mining with steam engines to suck water out of the mines, powered by coal at the time, but eventually some wood, all the railroad ties that had to be laid. Just the massive industrial revolution. You know, you have all these miners and you have all the loggers and all the transportation surrounding it. That's a lot of personnel that have to be fed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fed warm food by burning trees.
Right.
A lot of personnel that has to be housed. And so there was a lot of consumption of the forests, especially back east in the early times of the country, because that's where the population was.
Right.
Now, I imagine there are quite a few nice pieces of furniture created.
Sure, I mean, it's housing, it's stick lumber construction, and it seems as though, you know, when the U.S. forests were thinned or heading toward depletion, we went to Canada and started importing a lot of Canadian lumber. It's
You know, one of the interesting tidbits of living in Port Angeles is a lot of the old growth would be loaded onto tankers. Tankers probably not the right word. Large cargo ships.
Right.
In the port of Port Angeles. And, you know, one would assume that they're going to American mills. Well, a lot of those trees were shipped to Japan.
Hmm.
And in Japan, they were put in large ponds on top of each other until they sunk, just from the weight of the trees on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
And those trees were not being utilized. They were being stored.
Wow.
For the time that there would be no old growth available commercially. So, I mean, at least some companies in Japan recognized scarcity that was being created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What they ever did with them, I don't know. I moved on. But when I found that out, it just showed me how valuable this old growth is becoming internationally.
And these trees are hundreds of years old, is that right?
Yeah, 400 and 500 years old.
So a climax forest like that takes you know, 300-400 years to grow like that.
Yeah, and the environment has changed, and the rains aren't the same, the winter weathers aren't the same, and so the forests that were able to grow then don't have the same climactic conditions.
Hmm.
I don't believe that they grow as rapidly as they used to, but I'm not a forester.
Right.
But you look at all the fires that are going on in Colorado right now. What's burning is primarily lodgepole pine and the pines that were killed since the 1980s by a pine beetle,
right.
Which did their reproductive cycle didn't used to allow them to produce as much as they have in the areas that they have, all the way up through the Rocky Mountains up into Canada. So those hillsides have been standing there naked, especially the lodgepole pines forests, because lodgepole needs fire to regenerate, to pop open its pine cones.
Right.
So just like Yellowstone in, the 1980s, you come back 20 years later, and forests look pretty healthy. And I would imagine that the forests that are being burned now, 20 or 30 years from now, are going to be full of lodgepole pines. Unfortunately, 40, 50, 60 years from now, they'll I want to harvest them.
Right. In the meantime, we're making a lot of grassland.
Yeah. Yeah. Desertification. Anyway, the creation of deserts.
Right.
Over the last 1,000 years, the amount of deserts that have been created and enlarged, especially in the African area, in the Middle East. And it's coming here. So
I would think that's going to show the value of national parks, and that, again, preservation mandate. But it also puts a huge amount of pressure on the parks for further shrinkage of park size to increase extraction.
Mm-hmm. Or the changing of the rules and regulations to allow extraction inside national parks.
Right.
Not just of trees, but oil. And those darn grizzly bears.
Mm. Well, also, as you mentioned, with the loss of the greater ecosystem around the park refuges, the climate change results then put greater threat on the forests in the parks for fire. So it's it's not necessarily a sustainable refuge in the face of continued, as you mentioned, desertification, or global warming, weather changes where things are drying out and susceptible to fire.
Right. Which gets back to carrying capacity, which is something I thought about in about our interviews in the past. I thought I'd mention it.
Now please.
It's popped in the brain again. I don't know. It was after I retired from the Joshua Tree, so 2010, so I don't know, 2013, 2014, I was invited by the chief of resources at Joshua Tree National Park to speak with a college group working on their master's on ecosystem management, something like that. And I said, so during the conversation, I said, so tell me what is carrying capacity? And to their credit, they were able to roll out the definition of carrying capacity as taught by our institutions of higher learning. And it reminded me of me back in the 70s. And we know what carrying capacity is. We can define that. But over the years, I've sort of developed a different opinion on carrying capacity. And we, as humans and people that are concerned about preserving national parks, we like to talk about the human carrying capacity. And of course, we know what the carrying capacity of bison or elk, cougar, bear is as far as the land is related. But to me, it's all very short term. I like to think about the carrying capacity of the earth. And regardless of what we do, eventually the human species will go away and the earth will still be here.
Mm-hmm.
I read a book called Eocene, I think it was called. And it's a book by a futurist. In fact, I have it right here. It was called The Novocene by James Lovelock. You might want to look it up. In there, he mentions that between 5 and 6 billion years from now, the sun will have grown in size that will have absorbed Mercury, Venus, and Earth before it implodes. And so when we talk about carrying capacity, we're talking about how many people here for the next 50 years or the next 100 years.
Right.
And the Earth, Gaia, is this little entity that's more concerned about carrying capacity for the next several billion years.
Right.
And it's just a different way of looking at stuff. And we get pretty concerned about that spotted owl nailed to that sign at the entrance station at Olympic National Park. But those are just, you know, just like I've mentioned, dogs off leash in a park.
Mm.
Just one small, tiny spot of dust on everything else that the Earth is dealing with.
Yeah.
That's my philosophy for the day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get the narrative of history here.
No, it's very fascinating as the parks, you know, it, looking at human care and capacity. Parking lots are full. Is the answer to build more parking lots? Trails and overlooks are full. Is the answer to build more? You know, at the South Rim of Grand Canyon, the concept has always been slated out by the state. Hey, let's just build another South Rim a little further to the west. And you end up paving paradise to put up a parking lot.
Exactly.
And
where are they going to get the water for that second South Rim?
Pump it up from the river and, mm-hmm. you know, take it from downstream users who are thirsty and and take it from upstream users who have little. And yeah.
And to hell with Mexico.
Well, exactly. So it's whether it's a Grand Canyon issue or it's Olympic National Park issue. Human carrying capacity is starting, I think, to really look at managers, national park managers, right in the face. And again, how to do that in a tourist-based economy, where everybody wants, you know, more tourism. In your time at the park, including Joshua Tree, did you have resource managers that were looking at this and were visiting with you saying, you know, we're really concerned about this and we're going to have to start thinking about this?
It was a conversation that went on every day.
Okay.
Yeah. Went on every day. And, I would hope that the people that support the parks and use the parks would have a concept of carrying capacity and the need to put limits on visitation. And of course, the ones that just cruise through the park because it's the shortest distance between two points don't really give it much consideration. And the people that never go to the parks, the vast majority of Americans, don't really give it much consideration. So I don't think that the American public and the American politicians are anywhere near supporting those concepts, especially when it stares in the face of economics for local communities and commercial operators. So it's a discussion that goes on very frequently in the national parks. I think it goes on frequently in the Forest Service and the BLM, even though they have different mandates. So hold on a second. I have to yell at my cats here. There. That was called yelling. All you have to do is get up.
That did it.
Grab the spray bottle. Hold on a sec. They're going in the back room here. Okay. That's resolved.
All right.
So where were we?
Well, we're carrying capacities, yeah.
So it would be nice to hear some leaders start talking about carrying capacity. And, you know, I understand it's hard. The population of this country continues to grow and grow and grow, and people need the outdoors. Fortunately, for most of the BLM and Forest Service lands, you can still go and not see very many people.
Right.
Fortunately for the national parks, they're so well publicized that It's very difficult, even in the off-season. There is no off-season anymore for many of our national parks.
Right.
They just keep coming, and that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to provide for their enjoyment, but only in such a way that their children and their children's children can see the same thing.
Right.
Which even now they're not vignettes of pre-European man. They're, in my opinion, getting to be more and more like museums.
Hmm. Well, that's another interesting question I'd be interested in your opinion on. Unimpaired, what's the snapshot of an impairment? Is it what Lewis and Clark saw in the early 1800s? Is it what was happening in 1490? Was it what was happening 13,000 years ago? What's the vision of unimpairment?
I think it's undefinable.
Okay, interesting.
I think you can't. I don't know that you could ever get a group representing multiple different perspectives to agree on impairment. And that argument goes on, every day, every year. Because this administration is trying to open up part of an Alaskan national park for oil exploration.
Right.
That argument's been going on for decades. It was going on before, with the creation of the Alaskan national parks. The company says, we can explore for oil and extract oil in a safe manner, and the environment will not be at threat. I don't think you'll get any conservation group to agree to that. And, eventually the infrastructure will corrode, just like all the other infrastructures in this nation. And it won't be kept up to snuff. So eventually there will be a catastrophic environmental problem based on oil exploration, extraction. And maybe eventually we'll get to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf as a prime example.
Right.
These oil crisis is another one. So, unimpaired. How do you maintain the homeostasis of an environment in the entire world? Climate is changing. Is that a natural occurrence? I mean, obviously we've been through several ice ages. Those are natural occurrences. The vegetation, animal life that existed prior to the last ice age is greatly impaired. So impairment must come from man's activity, humankind's activity. So how do you get all these people to agree on what? I guess the current argument on climate change
right.
is a great example.
Yep.
We're not impairing anything. It's not our fault. Versus we're impairing everything. It's all our fault. Hopefully someplace in the middle there's an answer to that. And I think it's further complicated by the masses of humanity in this world that are living in poverty with no hope of any change ever.
Mm.
And they don't really care about impairment.
Right.
What they care about is finding their next basket of wheat.
Exactly.
Or their next water container that's not polluted. Or where they're going to get their heating sources for their family's health. So. So it makes for interesting discussions at training sessions.
No doubt. Well, let's pull this back to Olympic. Then at one point, you ended up leaving Olympic. How did that happen?
Well, let's see. So I got to Olympic in 88. East District Ranger, Acting Chief Ranger, East District Ranger, Chief Ranger. I think it just got to a point, our son was going to be graduating from high school and moving on. I just decided that it was time to go to the next level, which was superintendent. So I put myself, with the support of my superintendent and assistant superintendent, into a, I didn't put myself, I applied for and was accepted into a training program called the Executive Potential Program, the EPP, which was a year-long training session. I just had another fun thought.
What's that?
So there were three, over that course of the year, there were, I think, three times when you went to a designated location. It was usually around Washington, D.C. And there were probably 50 people in the training session I was in.
Okay.
And you also had to do three different shadow assignments. No, three different one-month assignments with somebody at the management level higher than you, and it could be anywhere. One of the fellas put in an application to serve all 3 months in one locale, and he applied to go to the Vatican.
Wow.
Which I thought was kind of creative. It's a good way to get to Italy for 3 months. I had training assignments with the Forest Service and another Park Service assignment.
Where did you go? And so this had to be, you had to be a month, up to 3 months, with a level higher than where you were. You're Chief Ranger. So what's higher than a Chief Ranger?
Superintendent, regional office, Washington office.
So in the Forest Service, what would that equate to? Again, a regional office in the Forest Service or a Washington office, or BLM, or another?
Yeah.
Okay.
Superintendent of the park is equivalent to supervisor of the National Forest.
Okay.
And they have regional offices, and they have the Washington, D.C. office. So I took one of those months. I went to Legislative Affairs in Washington, D.C.
What was that like?
Enabling Act of the Park Service, the Enabling Act for the Park, the administrative intent of Congress, the formation of National Park Service units. And then you run it up through the channels. And it's just incredibly interesting. This fella was able to take what he wrote and edit it in such a way that it was acceptable to both sides of the both sides of the Congress. And then it went over to the staff, career staff people for the various congressmen and senators in their various committees. The senators and the congressmen don't do all the legwork. Their staff does.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the relationship with the various career professionals who are now answering to the Speaker of the House or the Senate Pro Tem, and getting these things into a form that can be passed by Congress as law was just amazingly interesting to me. The inner workings of our federal government. So that was one part of it. And then you also had to shadow somebody for a week. And so one of my other 1 month assignments, which was going to be 2 months, was contacted by the regional director, which was John Jarvis at the time, and asked if I would like to go to Joshua Tree National Park for a 2 month assignment. And the reason for that was Ernie Quintana was the superintendent of the park, and he was in the Senior Executive Service Training Program.
How do you spell his name?
Ernie, E-R-N-I-E, Quintana is Q-U-I-N-T-A, Quintana.
Q-U-I-N-T-A, Quintana. Okay, and you were talking about the SES.
Yeah, but Quintana, Q-U-I-N-T-A-N-A, there you go.
Ah, thank you.
So he had been on 2 month training assignment already in Washington, D.C. as an acting deputy director, and the region had tried to have Olympic National Park supervised on a rotating basis by the four or five chiefs of each division, interpretation, maintenance, administration, rangers, I think that's it. Oh, resource management. And there was so much animosity between those five chiefs that region decided that they needed to send somebody down there to be the acting superintendent for 2 months. So they picked me as part of my EPP training program. And I went down there for about a month, 6 weeks. And it was time for me to go to Washington, D.C. and shadow the deputy director, who was Randy Jones. Randy Jones had been my assistant superintendent at Olympic.
Huh.
And he had transferred from Olympic as assistant superintendent to deputy director.
And, of course, you knew John Jarvis from the past as well.
Right. Yeah, good old boy club. I like to think some of it was based on my merit, but who knows.
Hang on a second, Kurt. I'm a little confused. You mentioned these four or five different resources and protection and four or five different groups, and they weren't getting along together. Was that at Olympic they weren't getting along, or was that at Joshua Tree they weren't getting along?
That was at Joshua Tree.
Okay.
That was at Joshua Tree. And it's probably not fair to say all five of them weren't getting along. I think two or three of them just couldn't stand each other.
Okay.
So I've been there about, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, and it was time for me to go shadow Randy Jones in Washington, D.C. And this is the story, part of the story, on how I got to Joshua Tree National Park, and I find it fascinating. So I'm following Randy Jones around, and in his opinion, shadow means shadow. And every meeting that he went to, he brought me to.
Nice.
And every meeting that he had in his office, I sat in the office. So one Monday, we're sitting in the office, and the chief of the park police comes in unannounced and says, Randy, I have to talk to you. I have to talk to Fran. Fran Minella was the director of the Park Service at the time. When the chief of police of the Park Service of the National Park Police shows up in your office unannounced, something's up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Randy said, okay, go ahead. We'll meet now. And she looked over at me like, don't you think he should leave? And he said, no. Go ahead. So the chief of the park police proceeded to inform Randy Jones that the preceding weekend, the park police, I'm not sure in what town, but it was close to the Statue of Liberty, had attempted to pull over an individual who failed to stop and drove to his house, and they were able to apprehend him on the front stoop. He had to run up several stairs to get to the front porch and trying to get into his house. And they were in the process of arresting him when his wife came out and got in an altercation with the park police and tried to prevent them from arresting him. Well, that wife happened to be the superintendent of the Statue of Liberty.
Uh-huh.
Who was now in an altercation with the park police and obstructing justice, so to speak. She was on the short list for being the Midwest Regional Director. In fact, the following week, she was scheduled to come in and meet with the Director of the Park Service and be selected as the Midwest Regional Director. Well, she got arrested and released. So you now have a superintendent that's been arrested that you're considering for a regional directorship. And Randy said, well, I guess we need to go talk to Fran. So all of us go down to Fran's office, and the chief of police waits outside, chief of the park police. Randy goes into an existing meeting, and I go with him. And Fran says, what's up? He says, I need to talk to you. So she says, all right. I need everybody to leave. So I start to get up and leave, and Randy reaches over and puts his hand on my forearm. Says, sit down.
Wow.
I'm going, okay. So now it's Fran, Randy, and I. And Fran looks at me and said, did you not hear what I said? And Randy says, well, this is Kurt Sauer. He's my shadow, part of the EPP program, and I told him to stay. She looks at Randy and says, I told him to leave. Randy looks at me, nods. I get up, leave.
Yeah.
So they call in the chief of the park police. She briefs the director of the park service. And as I was told, she's done. She leaves. And Randy says, or Fran says to Randy, okay, so now what do we do? And Randy said, Fran, you've got the Midwest Regional Director sitting three offices down here. He's Ernie Quintana. He's here on a four-month training assignment. So they called Ernie in and offered him the Midwest Regional Director position, which meant that the superintendent position at Joshua Tree was now vacant, or would be vacant in 30 days. So Ernie came back. I went back to Olympic National Park for 2 weeks, came back to Joshua Tree, worked with Ernie for a week so that he could brief me on everything that was going on. And he left, and I continued on in my, quote, two-month training assignment for another 8 months until they got around to advertising the job and then offered me the superintendency. And, you know, it had been 2-3 months. I was going home every 6 to 8 weeks for 2 weeks off, back in the Olympic, and then come back. And I decided, you know, I just sort of need to stay here at the park in case they call. And it went on and on and on. I said, well, I'm going to go home and see my wife and kid. So I went home and took some leave. And happened to be out on a golf course in Port Angeles with the chief law enforcement officer playing golf, and got a phone call. And it was the deputy regional director, Art. And said, we'd like to offer you the job at Joshua Tree National Park. And I said, yep, I'd be more than happy to take that job. Which was interesting because, I don't know, so that's late 2002. So 28 years of seasonal time and permanent time. And all during that time, I had told myself that I would never work in California. And I would never work in a desert.
I was going to say, all those years in the forest.
So, you know, desert? Huh. I'm a Rocky Mountain boy. I worked at Grand Canyon, which is a upside-down mountain, although vegetation's different. Worked in North Cascades. I worked in Olympic. They have trees. They have rivers. They have greens. So I took this two-month training assignment at Joshua Tree. And, you know, on weekends I had plenty of time to go explore the park, get familiar with the park. And I remember vividly flying in commercially into Palm Springs, and you could see the park in the distance, but you flew over San Gorgonio and San Bernardino Mountains, and mountain aesthetic biased way, I'd look at those and say, those aren't mountains, those are foothills. And boy, it sure is brown. It was at the end of a 2-year drought in California. So I flew in, drove up, and it's like, oh, it's brown, I don't like this stuff. Well, I started going hiking, found out how quiet it was, how peaceful the desert is, and on the third weekend, I was out hiking to a historic site, an old mining site, and no trail to it, just a place that I was told about. It's actually in a hiking book. And I remember sitting down for lunch on Boulder and looking across the valley, and seeing nothing but brown, because I'd come from Olympic. It's kind of vivid green. Not just the trees, but the moss and the lichen and everything up there is green. And that boy sure is brown. So I'm sitting there eating my sandwich, and I look down and I see a little lizard close to my foot, and he's eating something. I looked carefully, and he was eating a blade of grass. And that blade of grass was green, different shade of green. And I remember looking up from seeing the lizard and that blade of grass, and that hillside that was brown became green. And it was like my brain had rewired. And you know, I was able to see green. And then spring came, and it actually rained. And that desert It wasn't one of the record wildflower years, thank goodness, because nobody bothered to rush out to Joshua Tree. And ever since that day with the lizard at lunch, I was able to see green in the desert. Just a different state. I mean, I'm sitting here. We're not in the desert where I live right now, but we're right on the edge. And the hillsides, which used to be totally green, and the apple fire were pretty well burned up. There's probably 20% of the vegetation left. But when I look up at those hills, my eyes immediately go to the green of the forests that are still left.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to make myself look at the brown and the black of the fire. So I fell in love with Joshua Tree. Some lady got arrested in New York. Ernie Quintana got assigned as the regional director in Omaha. And 8 months later, I was selected as the superintendent of Joshua Tree.
Interesting.
And that's how I got there. Because, if that incident, the Statue of Liberty area, had not occurred, Ernie would not have been selected as soon as he was. I would have gone back to Olympic, and who knows where I would have ended up.
You know, this is really fascinating, the executive potential program, and the fact that you had a chance to spend some time in Joshua Tree, kind of shadowing, just getting a chance to learn what was going on there. It seemed like it just made for a perfectly soft landing.
Yeah. I think it was pretty soft. A couple of the division chiefs didn't think it was pretty soft, but the whole way it worked out, and prior to the executive potential program and being an Olympic, I really wasn't paying much attention to executive potential programs, senior executive service program. And that gets me back to, I mentioned an interesting thought I had earlier. When I went to the executive potential program, as far as I knew, the Park Service had maybe, 10 senior executive service employees. That number could be entirely wrong, but it wasn't very many. But I'm in this training program with all these folks from Washington, D.C. primarily, from all the different agencies, Coast Guard, Forest Service, Department of Treasury, Department of State. And every one of them had this phrase, which I thought was so interesting. Well, my SES says, my SES thinks that we should, meaning their supervisor was a graduate of the Senior Executive Service Training Program and was a Senior Executive Service employee, which is not a civil service pay grade. So we had, 10 superintendents maybe, or regional directors that were SES, maybe 20. But back in Washington, D.C., there are hundreds of them. And the Park Service, and probably the Forest Service, the BLM, we're out here, we've got 10 or 20 SESers managing some of the most valuable lands of this nation, and you've got SESers in Washington, D.C. that are managing parts of the budget and parts of the State Department. So it was a real eye-opener for me that there just weren't that many senior executive service positions in the Park Service. Now, I believe since that time that number has gone up. But back in 2002, it was still pretty rare. You were GS-15 superintendent. You were GS-15 regional director. And that must have been changing because Ernie went into the regional directorship as an SES position in Omaha. So I imagine all the regional directors were senior executive service. maybe at that time, Yosemite, Yellowstone. I'd have been senior executive service employees. So I...
And the SES, those people can move from different places quite a bit, can't they?
Yeah, they can move, and they can be moved.
Okay.
Well, I don't like that decision, John, so you're going to Timbuktu.
Huh.
Africa. Yeah.
And who does the moving? Is that the director or the Secretary of Interior who says, I don't like that decision you made, I'm moving you out?
The superintendents work for the regional director.
Yep.
The regional director works for the director. If the director says the person is moving, the regional director might say, well, no, we don't want to do that. And just like Fran told Randy, I told him to leave.
Right, right.
That superintendent leaves. And the director of the Park Service works for the Secretary of Interior. The Secretary of Interior works for the President.
Right.
So any SES position can be moved any place at any time. In fact, the superintendent, I don't know that for a fact, so I won't mention that. Hearsay was that the Statue of Liberty superintendent was moved to an office in the region with no windows.
Ooh.
And no assignment.
Ooh.
So, I think she found a different career path.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's Washington, D.C. is a beautiful city to visit, the monuments and the museums. And, it's the center of our government. It's just an amazing place to visit. And the inner workings of it are cutthroat.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. So when you moved to Joshua Tree now, then did you complete the EPP program and get and become an SES employee?
No, EPP wasn't SES level.
Okay.
SES training, which was 4 months, is the next level up from GS 14-15.
Okay.
I was a GS 13 Chief Ranger at Olympic, and I took a GS 14 superintendency at Joshua Tree.
So the EPP program was to help Park Service employees move to the next level into the superintendency level.
Yeah, it's basically a superintendent training program.
Okay.
In the Park Service.
Great.
And I think they, in addition to that, I think the Park Service now has a superintendent. When you're selected as a superintendent, I think you go to another superintendent training program. They may have gotten rid of it by now because of funding. But maybe, hopefully not. And so now you're working with new superintendents being instructed, taught, exposed to experienced superintendents and regional director personnel. And getting a perspective on the politics of being a superintendent.
Okay.
And the responsibilities of being a superintendent. So at least when I was there until 2010, I think the Park Service evolved greatly, and I think a lot of it was because of Director Jarvis, John Jarvis,
mm-hmm.
And his staff. He surrounded himself with excellent employees. So the superintendents received, or at least in my time, received excellent training, exposure, and experience. Yeah, it was an interesting time.
Yeah.
And I ended up at Joshua Tree.
I really just want to, you know, say how fortunate you were to work for Randy. It sounds like, I mean, just a really good individual to shadow.
Was phenomenal. And as assistant superintendent, he was responsible for writing the plan, or at least working the politics that resulted in the removal of the Elwha Dam and the Lower Dam. Excellent politician.
Wow.
That's the wrong phrase. He was excellent at working with the elected representatives. How's that? Because he wasn't a politician. He was pretty straightforward. Pretty happy-go-lucky when he wasn't working, which was about 3 hours a day. You could drive by headquarters at 8, 9 o'clock at night, and Randy was in his office.
Hmm.
When I was shadowing him, I remember one morning, walked in and I was walking down the corridors of the Department of Interior building. Remember which floor. And, you know, it was probably 8 o'clock. Randy was already there, but he was walking the other way. And I said, "Morning, Randy." "Morning." And he just kept walking. I turned around and started walking with him. He said, "What's up?" I said, "I don't think I can do this. I don't think I can do this today." We walked another 10 steps and he stopped. And turned around and said, "The hell with it." And he walked down the corridor and went back in his office and worked all day. And after he was deputy director, I transferred out to Rocky Mountain National Park as superintendent. And died of cancer.
Ooh.
And I always wondered to myself, was he fighting cancer when he was in D.C.?
Mm.
And he was so sick that day that he just couldn't go on. And then forced himself to turn around and go back to work.
Wow.
That's how committed he was to the National Park Service.
Wow.
And he was a pretty good racquetball player, too.
Huh.
Used to whip my butt, which irritated me a lot, because I was the chief ranger and I was in shape and he was just this assistant superintendent.
And you weren't a competitive kind of guy, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he'd been playing racquetball since before I was born. That's not true because we were the same age.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah, he was a wonderful man.
Wow. So you got any other Randy stories?
Oh. There's lots of random stories, I guess. We were traveling someplace, staying at some resort for a meeting, conference. And after dinner, I guess it was, we're walking down the hallway back to the elevators to go to the rooms. And he stops and he looks at this dress that's in this window. And I'm like, looking at the price tag. He said, "You know, I'm going to get that for my wife." I said, "Really?" I said, "Yep. She puts up with a lot." So he was married to a fine lady whose name I don't recall right now. Probably was Mrs. Jones at the time. And, you know, it just with everything going on, this dress caught his eye, and it was like, I'm getting that for my wife.
Nice.
So he was in love with her and the Park Service.
That's a hard balance to maintain.
When you think about the number of hours that he worked, and I came to find out that that was true of many of the people at the regional and Washington level, they got a salary, and they were hired because they got the jobs done. It wasn't eight to fives. Yeah, and when I hear people make fun of government employees, my exposure to the government employees, they're totally dedicated.
Right.
And the ones that are successful give hundreds of hours of their time. I happen to think that federal employees are pretty fine people.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are those that you end up putting in jail for 8 months because they sort of screwed up. But by far and away, especially, well, I only know for sure the Park Service, just outstanding employees.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we've been talking here about a little over an hour, and I wonder if this is a good place to wrap up this part 9, and we'll pick up with Joshua Tree.
All right, sounds like plan.
Okay. Well, with that, this will conclude part 9 Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Kurt Sauer. Today's October 26, 2020. My name's Tom Martin, and Kurt, thank you so very much.
You betcha, Tom.